Hello, everybody. It's the 11th episode of our Tebow book study. We're going to be starting at Anonymity, the Ego Reducer, and this is a very interesting one because it was a speech given before the Second International Convention, the AA Comes of Age Convention. And if you look at AA Comes of Age in the back, Tebow's got a paper called Therapeutic Mechanisms of Alcoholics Anonymous, which covers much of the territory we're talking about here. But anyway, that's where it came from. It's short. It's 7 pages. The following one is a Grapevine article. It's 4 pages long, and then we have a very short Grapevine article after that, and then finally there's a paper on why psychiatrists fail. So I don't know. We're probably going to combine a couple of those, the shorter ones maybe, or maybe we'll get into the second one today, depending on time. Okay, so page 103, Anonymity, the Ego Reducer. Under ordinary circumstances, I should thank the man who introduced me for his very nice remarks, but also for years I've been making a name for ego reduction. I'm not sure my ego got sufficiently reduced by the introduction. When the invitation came to speak before this group, I immediately said, yes, I want to go. For many years, as you all know, I've been associated with AA. All the experiences that I had came flashing through my mind, and I had so much to say that I didn't know quite where to begin. And with your permission, I'm going to use a manuscript so that the points that I want to make will not be forgotten. At an AA meeting, the speaker, as a rule, identifies himself as an alcoholic and then proceeds to tell his story, sprinkling garlands of wisdom, humor, or both as he goes along. I shall also tell my story, though I'm much less sure about my matching either the wit or the wisdom of the AA speakers. Suzanne?
Yeah, I'm not sure what's happening. Let me try to mute the line and then just press star 6 to unmute. Okay,
did
hold
you
on.
Hear So were you going to read the next, Suzanne?
Sure. Sorry about that.
No problem.
Okay. Can you tell me where we are?
Right. Oh, did you miss the first part? Yeah. All right. So we're going to use a mentor point. Okay. I joined AA by proxy.
Okay. I joined AA by proxy in 1939 when a patient of mine became a member of the New York group. Well, do I remember my first AA meeting? It was tinged with excitement. AA was going on the air for the first time. One of the members, trying to rehabilitate himself, had talked with Gabriel Heater, who, on hearing his story, suggested that he, the AA man, appear on the program, We the People. This was a night far too thrilling and special for settling down to a regular meeting. The actual event was a bit of a letdown. The man from AA spoke briefly of his experiences. Gabriel Heater, plainly puzzled, had a couple of pointless questions, and it was over. AA, however, had taken a step toward making itself known. Not a very big step, to be sure, but one of the many that finally led to present position on the national and international scene. Later, I attended other meetings more orthodox in character. As I did, I developed a conviction that the group had hit upon a method that solved the problem of excessive drinking. In a sense, it was an answer to my prayers. After years of butting my head against the problem of treating the alcoholic, one could begin to hope. In retrospect, my first 2 or 3 years of contact with AA were the most exciting in my whole professional life. AA was then in its miracle phase. Everything that happened seemed strange, wonderful. Hopeless drunks were being lifted out of the gutter. Individuals who had sought every known means of help without success were responding to this new approach. To be close to any such group, even by proxy, was electrifying.
I'll bet. Yeah. I'll bet it was, huh?
Yeah.
Can you imagine?
Who was Gabriel Heater?
Oh, apparently, just from context, a radio host. I read, AA comes of age. No, not AA comes of age. As Bill, no, not as Bill sees it. The biography of Bill. I forget that it's fallen out of my brain now. I read about it, and apparently he was a TV personality. And didn't get it. But he put us on the air.
Okay. Should I continue, Suzanne, or do we want to comment?
Yeah, if anybody has any comments.
I just wanted to say one thing about that Gabriel Heater. You can actually listen to that on the internet. I've listened to that talk before.
That would be
cool.
Yeah, so go ahead, Terry.
Okay. In addition, professionally, a whole new avenue of problems of alcohol had opened up. Somewhere in the AA experience was the key to sobriety. There was the first authentic clue after many years of fruitless efforts. Needless to say, the possibilities ahead were most intriguing. Perhaps I could learn how AA worked and thus could learn something about how people stop drinking, all of which meant that I'd shared in the general excitement of those days. I could see some daylight ahead. My future in regard was now clear. I would try to discover what made AA tick. In the quest for understanding, I would never have gotten beyond first base if it had not been for Bill and many of the early members. The study of the 12 steps helped a little, but of a far greater importance was the many insights already possessed by Bill and others into the process through which AA brought about in results. I heard of the need to hit bottom, of the necessity for accepting a higher power, of the indispensability of the humility, ideas that had never crossed my professional horizon and certainly had never influenced my non-professional thinking or attitudes. Revolutionary as they were, these ideas nevertheless made sense, and I found myself embarked on a tour of discovery. I began to recognize more clearly what hitting bottom really implied. I began to do what I could to induce the experience in others, always wondering what was happening inside the individual as he went through the crisis of hitting bottom. Pass.
So one thing about this is that we're hearing Tebow talk to a bunch of alcoholics and not his colleagues, and he's acknowledging and recognizing more of the program than he did with, and from my perspective. He talks about a higher power here, and maybe he's going to actually say God. And, I think that he was plugged into that spiritual angle, but just wasn't showing it with his colleagues. There's actually in the AA Comes of Age article, he deals with that too.
This is Suzanne. And what I really noticed in this essay or this talk that he gave is that for me it was much easier to read, and it's just much easier to understand than the ones he's talking to the psychiatric community.
Yeah. The recording of this speech is out there, but I really suggest you stick with the printed. He's a horrible speaker. Nasal, and much better to read it.
I'm sorry. Didn't catch you.
So who's next?
Oh, Bob is next.
I'm next. Okay. Finally, fortune smiled upon me again, this time in the form of another patient. For some period, she had been under my new brand of psychotherapy designed to promote hitting bottom. For reasons completely unknown, she experienced a mild but typical conversion, which brought her into a positive state of mind. Led by her newly found spiritual elements, weak though they were, she started attending various churches in town. One Monday morning, she entered my office, her eyes ablaze, and at once commenced talking. "I know what happened to me. I heard it in church yesterday. I surrendered." With that word, surrender, she handed me my first real awareness of what happens during the period of hitting bottom. The individual is fighting the admission of being licked, of admitting that he is powerless. If and when he surrendered, he quit fighting, could admit he was licked, and could accept that he was powerless and needed help. If he did not surrender, 1,000 crises could hit him and nothing would happen. The need to induce surrender became the new therapeutic goal. The miracle of AA was now a little clearer. For reasons still obscure, the program and the fellowship of AA could induce a surrender, which could in turn lead to a period of no drinking. As might be expected, I too had a thrill of my own. I was getting in on what was happening, always an enjoyable experience. Still questing eagerly, I shifted my therapeutic attack. The job now was to induce surrender. When I tried to cause that, I ran into a whole nest of resistances to that idea, totally new territory to be explored. As I continued my tour, it became ever more apparent that in everyone's psyche there existed an unconquerable ego that bitterly opposed any thought of defeat. Until that ego was somehow reduced or rendered ineffective, no likelihood of surrender could be anticipated. Pass.
Well, that's... Notice he says, in everyone's psyche. So not just in the alcoholics. You know, I needed to surrender. I had to. So, you know, that's, I did. But a lot of times people don't have to. they're not treating their psyche the way I was with drugs and alcohol.
This is Suzanne, and I think this is interesting, the way that he says for reasons still obscure. I think that obscure is really an important word there. The program and the fellowship of AA could induce, and I think induce is an interesting word to use there, too, a surrender, which in turn could lead to a period of no drinking. And I believe that we each have to get there on our own. I think hearing other people can possibly help us to get there, but I don't believe the fellowship solely can get me there. I think it's almost a gift from a spiritual power to be able to actually experience surrender. And I'm wondering, though, if this is something that could be shared, because I hear it all the time. How do I surrender? And so he goes on, you know, in the next little while more, but I think this is interesting, just the way that he is, you know, kind of discussing it. And, you know, in one sense, I think if you're having difficulty with surrender, it's important to continue to come to meetings and continue to listen and, you know, continue to... look at terms like willingness and really also look, again, at desperation. But I'm not... I'll stop there, and we can continue to read. And
this is Bob. I have some to follow up on with that, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Before you said that, Susan, you know, I was going to say something about that line that says the fellowship of AA could induce a surrender, that I felt like you did. Like, it wasn't, The AA couldn't induce my surrender. It was, you know, a higher, some other power greater than me. But then I thought about the meeting I was at tonight, and like my first surrender was not induced by AA. My first surrender was to come. The idea came into my head that I had to stop doing what I was doing, that it was over. And the next surrender was a day later when I agreed to go to AA and I walked into a meeting room. And so I had lots of surrenders throughout, I think, throughout the process, and I think other people do too. The surrender that the Fellowship of AA helped me with, and this really was clear to me tonight at our meeting, is that once I surrendered and I was in the room, and then I would go to the meetings, and I surrendered to do what other people told me to do. Once I got there, the resistance to work the steps and to really live in the AA way, that resistance was, the surrender to doing that process came about by me being at the meet, like what you were just saying towards the end, being at the meetings and getting a network and getting a bunch of guys who encouraged me and, you know, stressed to me that I needed to get a sponsor and that I needed to have a network and I needed to make phone calls. So the initial surrender I had to have, at least for me, and I'm sure, like you just said, there's people that come into meetings who haven't surrendered yet at all. They just come because they either think they should or someone told them to. But you can also, the fellowship for me helped me surrender to the rest of the process. It wasn't the original surrender. It wasn't the bottom. Hitting my bottom, which had nothing to do with AA, was what got me to surrender initially.
Mm-hmm.
But the fellowship helped me surrender to the rest of it. And because, like a lot of people, I was in resistance to God and doing the steps. And by being there and hearing other people and being encouraged by other people and having other people take me under their wing and say, if you want what I have, this is what you should do. I mean, I resisted that, but if I didn't keep going there, it would not have induced a surrender. So it did induce a surrender as far as that part of my recovery went.
Yeah, this is Howard. I totally agree with that. I mean, when I got sober, the people I did got sober with were instrumental, really, in keeping me focused and keeping me and presenting the material and all of that, you know, it was, and exemplifying lives that were being lived with people I knew had the same experiences as I do, but they were living, sober lives, you know, and having fun. So yeah, it was a huge experience for me, but I think what Tebow's talking about, of course, is the reduction of ego, right? For him, that's what surrender is that reduction of the primary, unconquerable ego. And, you know, but I think going through that whole thing, all of that is ego reduction. All that of listening to other people, opening up to other ideas, that's ego reduction. So, I mean, you start off getting knocked flat, and it's not AA that does that. You know, it's reality, or it's God, right, that does that. And it's not just reality doing it, it's the ability to get through my thick skull. You know, it was the miracle that I ever saw, you know, that perspective. You get a little bit of light and made a turn. So that's the miraculous thing. But I think, you know, again, he's looking at, even though he's talking to AAs and acknowledging spiritual elements, he's still talking like a psychiatrist for reasons still obscure. In other words, they don't know, he doesn't know, and he can't explain where that surrender comes from. So he's being honest there. And so, yeah, great comments.
Would you like to continue, Howard?
Okay, I just want to comment too. This is Terry. Totally identify in with that. Like I had two surrenders, you know, I came into the fellowship and didn't do any of the work and just, you know, stayed in the fellowship and stayed sober. So I always say, like, my first bottom got me to AA, and my second bottom got me to God, because I had that gift of desperation again to a complete full surrender the second time around. And that's when, after those 2 years of, you know, being dry and wanting to kill myself, it drove me to another bottom to, you know, have, pick up the steps and form this relationship with a power greater than myself. And I'm so grateful for both of those bottoms. So that's it.
Yep. Okay, so is it no likelihood of sooner? Is it the shift in emphasis?
Yes, that's what I think it is.
The shift in emphasis from hitting bottom to surrender to ego reduction all occurred during the first 5 or 6 years after my initial contact with AA. I well remember the first AA meeting to which I spoke on the subject of ego reduction. AA, still very much in its infancy, was celebrating the third or fourth anniversary of one of the groups. The speaker immediately preceding me told in detail the efforts of his local group, which consisted of two men, to get him to dry up and become its third member. After several months of vain effort on their part and repeated nosedives on his, the speaker went on to say, "Finally, I got cut down to size and have been sober ever since." The sobriety was a matter of some 2 or 3 years then. When my turn came to speak, I used his phrase, "cut down to size," as a text around which to weave my remarks. Before long, out of the corner of my eye, I was conscious of a disconcerting stare. It was coming from the previous speaker. Looking a little more directly, I could see his eyes fixed on me in open-eyed wonder. It was perfectly clear that he was utterly amazed that he had said anything that made sense to a psychiatrist. The look of incredulity never left his face for my entire talk. The incident had one value in my eyes. It showed that two people, one approaching the matter clinically and the other relying on his own intuitive report of what had happened to him, both came up with exactly the same observation, the need for ego reduction. Pass?
So that part of the talk has been used a lot in, you know, various material. It's that that piece is really familiar to me.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'll keep going. If nobody has any comments. During the past decade, my own endeavors have centered primarily upon this problem of ego reduction. How far I have been able to explore that territory is not at all certain. I have, however, made a little progress. I shall try first to acquaint you with some of my findings, and second, to relate them to the AA scene as I see it. As I have already stated, the fact that hitting bottom could produce a surrender that cut the ego to size was fairly evident soon. In time, two additional facts manifested themselves. The fact was that a reduced ego has marvelous recuperative powers. The second was that surrender is an essentially disciplinary function in experience. The first is merely repeating a fact known to you all. It is common knowledge that a return of the full-fledged ego can happen at any time. Years of sobriety, no insurance against its resurgence. No AA, regardless of his veteran status, can ever relax his guard against the encroachment of a reviving ego. I'll stop there because there's a lot in there.
Yeah. Well, this sums up what his ideas are and that he's laid out in his other papers in sort of summary form. You know, first of all, the disciplinary function. You know, my bottom changed my life. My first surrender changed my life. But I didn't think of it as a disciplinary function. But looking at it now, you know, I stopped doing what I was doing, and started doing something else. And that something else was more in accord with the reality around me. So, yeah, I mean, you know, I had a hard time living in the world, right, because of the way I looked at the world. And that's my ego charging ahead, right? And by God, that describes me to a T. You know, I was charging ahead and running into walls a lot. So the disciplinary function is something that he's talked about in the other paper, and also the resurgence of the ego. In other words, this is a mechanism whereby the warning that you never cured of alcoholism comes through, you know, is that that ego can snap back at any time.
It makes me also think of the spiritual malady. Because the spiritual malady, like I'm pressing down, but it never fully goes away, and it can come back at sometime when I don't know when it's going to necessarily pop right up, and it's that years of sobriety or no insurance against its resurgence.
Yeah.
And I'm not exactly sure if the reviving ego is the same as the spiritual malady.
I would think of it as a manifestation of that, you know,
mm-hmm.
So how that expresses itself in me. And there's more than that. But I hadn't considered that before. That's very interesting. But yeah, I like that idea that, you know, the spiritual things take form in us, you know, and embody themselves in us. So you know, you can think of my ego as embodying that spiritual malady.
Anybody else have any comments? Terry, would you like to read?
Sure. Recently, one AA, writing to another, reported he was suffering. He feared from halitosis, an obvious reference to the smugness and self-complacency that so easily can creep into the individual with the years of sobriety behind him. The assumption that one has all the answers, of the contrary, that one needs to know no answers and just follow AA, are two indicators of trouble. In both, open-mindedness is a notable absence. Perhaps it is the commonest manifestation of the return of ego is witnessed in the individual who falls from his pink cloud, a state of mind familiar to you all. This blissful pink cloud stated is a logical aftermath of surrender. The ego, which is full of striving, just quits, and the individual senses peace and quiet within. The result is an enormous feeling of release, and the person flies right up to his pink cloud and thinks he has found heaven on earth. Everyone knows he is doomed to fall, but he is perhaps not equally clear that it is the ego, slowly making its comeback, that forces the descent from the pink cloud into the arena of life, where with the help of AA, he can learn how to become a sober person and not an angel. I could go on with many examples familiar to you all of the danger of ever assuming that the ego is dead and buried. It is the capacity for rebirth is utterly astounding and must never be forgotten.
That was halitosis. Sorry, I talked over you there, but not halitosis, it's halitosis. In reference to the smugness and self-complacency. We are not saints.
Bob, do you want to continue?
I could go on with many more examples familiar to you all of the danger of ever assuming that the ego is dead and buried. Its capacity for rebirth is utterly astounding and must never be forgotten. My second finding, that surrender is a disciplinary experience, requires explanation. In recent articles, I have shown that the ego basically must be forging continuously ahead. It operates on the unconscious assumption that it, the ego, can never be stopped. It takes for granted its right to go ahead, and in this respect has no expectation of being stopped and no capacity to adjust to that eventuality. Stopping says, in effect, no, you cannot continue, which is the essence of disciplinary control. The individual who cannot take a stopping is fundamentally an undisciplined person. The function of surrender in AA is now clear. It produces that stopping by causing individuals to say, I quit, I give up my headstrong ways, I've learned my lesson. Very often for the first time in that individual's adult life, he has encountered surrender and truly feels, thy will, not mine, be done. When that is true, we have become, in fact, obedient servants of God. The spiritual life at that point is a reality. We have become members of the human race. Pass.
Yeah, so there's Tebow acknowledging God, essentially, which it's hard to find elsewhere in his work.
Would you like to continue, Howard?
It's also really interesting what he must mean by these drunks when he says they've now become members of the human race.
Yeah, well, I felt like an alien. Really, I didn't feel like I was a member of anything.
Anyway. That's putting it out there pretty bluntly by Tebow, though.
Well, it is. It fits. The shoe fits for me.
Sure. Yep.
Okay, so I have now presented the two points I wish to make, namely, first, the ego is revivable, and second, surrender is a disciplinary experience. I next wish to assess their significance for AA as I see it. Primarily, the two points say quite simply, AA can never just be a miracle. The simple act of surrender can produce sobriety by its stopping effect upon the ego. Unfortunately, that ego will return unless the individual learns to accept a disciplined way of life, which means the tendency for ego comeback is permanently checked. This is not new to AA members. They have learned that a single surrender is not enough. Under the wise leadership of the Founding Fathers, the need for continued endeavor to maintain that miracle has been steadily stressed. The 12 steps urge repeated inventory, not just one. And the 12th step itself is a routine reminder that one must work at preserving sobriety. Moreover, it is referred to as 12-step work, which is exactly what it is. By that time, the miracle is for the other fellow. So here's another thing he's doing, which is referring to the other steps, which you don't hear much. You know, he's concentrating on that original surrender. And but he's saying that from his perspective, the rest of the steps are there to maintain a disciplined life, you know, and I hate it when I hear that word. I don't like the word, but in fact, that's what's happening. You know, my urges, my instincts are regulated, you know, and they're not running wild the way they were. So that's disciplinary, you know, and they call it 12-step work, you know, and there's work in the steps, doing an inventory, et cetera. All of that is work. So, I like that approach by him.
This is Suzanne. And what I've found with the disciplined way of life is that by going through the 12 steps and beginning to have access to a power that I didn't have before, there's an internal willingness to want to be more disciplined. Mm-hmm. It feels better for me to be disciplined. And it's not like when I'm in self-will, I'm pushing myself to be disciplined. And when I'm working with a higher power, there's an internal desire, which for me is very, very different experience. It's how I notice when I'm in self-will. There's something else that I wanted to mention, too, and that is that the 12 steps urge repeated inventory, not just one. And I think that's a really important because a lot of people in the program, just in just general meetings, go through the steps once and that's it. Mm-hmm. And I'm just really, really grateful that I have a process where I don't stop with just one. I continue. And for me, I always refer to part of the big book where they're talking about Paw and coming out of the cellar. And there, you know, ain't no problem here. It's just a little windy. Well, there was a lot more going on with me in my life than just alcohol. And even just with doing my first, even before I started working with the Big Book, I was still doing repeated inventories because I didn't have access to a higher power, and I kept on trying different ways to see if I could get one. So I think where I was coming from was with a willingness to want to have what all the promises that the Big Book said. I truly believed they were possible, and I was very determined to just continue to, you know, keep on keeping on. And so I'll stop there. Thank you.
Well, I'd just like to say that, you know, after step three and actually having that, even though it was tentative the first time, I actually, you know, got it into my head that there was a different way to look at this thing, and that it was under this influence of this higher power that I could take a look and be honest about what I was talking about in the fourth step. It helped that I had a good friend as a sponsor, and so I was more trusting. But yeah, I mean, I couldn't have done it without that. Had to have that shift and that turning to bring out the willingness to be able to do it. So, got it.
This is Bob. So this paragraph about a single surrender is not enough, so that reminded me, took me to the 10th step. And from our book, where they write right in it, it is easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels, just what Tebow's talking about. And I just had this idea, the next line, of substituting the word ego for alcohol. We are headed for trouble if we do, for our ego is a subtle foe, and we are not cured of our ego.
That works.
And I mean, how true is that? Because when the ego comes back, it tells me I don't have to do this program anymore, and I can control the world, and I'm bigger and better than all of this. And I can, if the ego comes back enough, it tells me I have victory over alcohol on my own power. And once that happens, I'm done because I don't have the power. And you know, and earlier in the step, it says, you know, we vigorously commence this way of living. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. So I know a lot of times people say the 10 steps a maintenance step, but it's really, in order to maintain it, you got to work. I got to grow in my spiritual condition and grow in working and doing the inventory and keeping the disease and my ego in check. And that's only by working on my spiritual condition so that I don't get the spiritual unmanageabilities and let those things crop up that cause me to want to treat them with alcohol and other substances.
And this is Suzanne, and the way that I do that is I watch myself talk, and I use that as my spiritual practice during my day, is that I go back to just kind of trying to notice, like, okay, am I bothered about something, even if it's a little thing, or something scaring me. Those are the two things that I like specifically kind of look for. And sometimes it takes me a little time to notice that there is something even bothering me, but when I click into that, that's when I go through my 10-step process. There's something else that in the chapter above when, or a couple of above, when Thibaut says we've become members of the human race, I just wanted to say that I found that very interesting in the sense that since Thibaut is not someone in a 12-step program, the fact that he was able to see how uncomfortable alcoholics, addicts, I think really anyone in a 12-step program feels so out of the norm. I think that's an amazing insight that he was able to see without experiencing it. And I pass. Anybody else?
Well, that's, you know, he's a very empathetic guy. You know, he comes through in a lot of this stuff, a lot of insight. So, yeah.
Okay, so I'll continue. The 12 traditions are also part of the non-miracle aspect of AA. They represent, as Bill has said, the meaning of the lessons of experience. They serve as guides for the inexperienced. In reality, they check the ways of the innocent and unwary. They bring the individual down to earth and present him with the facts of reality. In their own fashion, the traditions say, pay heed to the teachings of experience or you will court disaster. It is with reason that we talk of the sober voice of experience. My stress on the non-miracle elements of AA has a purpose. When I first made my acquaintance with AA, I wrote the Pink Cloud with most of its members. I, too, went through a period of disillusionment, and fortunately for me, I came out with a faith stronger than anything a Pink Cloud can supply. Mind you, I'm not selling miracles short. They do loosen the individual up. I now know, however, the truth of the biblical saying, by their works you shall know him. Only through hard toil and labor can lasting results be obtained.
Mind you, I'm not selling miracles short. They do loosen the individual up. That is so, it seems to me that's dismissive, you know, of the spiritual experience. But, you know, he's looking at the practical long-term work, you know, which is spiritual work for us. But, you know, he's seeing that as toil, you know, trudging the road. And, you know, so I think, though, he's selling short the ongoing miracle. Although I think he mentions that in the following paragraphs.
I think it's interesting when he says, I, too, went through a period of disillusionment, and fortunately for me, I came out with a faith far stronger than anything a Pink Cloud can supply. And I know for me, when I've walked through things that have been very, very difficult, in the, you know, when just life experiences, walking through them without getting into addiction, I there's growth that comes through in terms of just hanging on and being patient. That, once again, is where I really needed to have my fellowship support me. And I did come, when I was able to turn back and look at the experience and see the hand of my higher power in a different way, because when, it seemed when I was walking through not feeling that there was a God there because I was so scared as to what was going on and heartbroken in a lot of ways too, that I was able to you know, see that hand differently. And it really did put a faith and a belief and a trust in me that I had never had before. It deepened my experience. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like the yin and the yang, that I needed to have that experience of really being pushed against the wall in a way that I've never been pushed against the wall, and seeing that everything, I mean, worked out beyond my wildest dreams.
Mm.
Terry, would you like to continue?
Sure. As a consequence of the need for work to supplement any miracle, my interest in the non-miracle features has grown. I can accept more truly the necessity of the organization of structure which curbs as well as guides. I believe there must be meetings like the ones to provide a sense of belonging to a big working organization of which each individual is but a part. And I believe that any group or individual who fails to participate in the enterprises of the organization is rendering himself and his group a disservice by not submitting to the disciplinary values inherited in those activities. He may be keeping the ego free of entanglement, but he is also keeping himself unstopped. His chances of remaining sober are not of a high order. He is really going it alone and is headed for another miracle that may not come off the next time. In closing, let me reaffirm my proxy membership in AA. I have been in on its glowing start, and I've shared in its growing pains. And now I have reached the state of deep conviction in the soundness of the AA process, including its miracle aspects. I have tried to convey to you some of my observations on the nature of that process. I hope they will help in making the AA experience not just a miracle, but a way of life that is filled with internal values. AA has, I can assure you, done just that for me.
Anybody have any final comments?
Well, there's kind of a, dare I say it, there's a kind of a fascist element in that. Be in the organization or get drunk. I have nothing against GSR or any of that, but I think it's a little extreme to say you'll get drunk if you don't do it. But anyway, that's him speaking to alcoholics. It's the first one we've had where he's doing that, and we get a different face of Tebow. It's the same material that he's been talking about all along, but he's presenting it differently. And the context, of course, is the AA comes of age international convention, so that probably explains the organizational plug at the end there. And, you know, discipline in general seems to me is required. I need that. I'm very undisciplined. I'm very, you know, I definitely want to let things slide. You know, I have to keep in touch with reality and my higher power to get myself motivated to do anything just the way I am. So, that's all I got.
It's Susanna. I have one more thing, and that is that when he talks about on page 109, the 12 traditions are also part of the non-miracle aspect of AA. They represent, as Bill has said, the meanings of the lessons of experience. They serve as guides for the inexperienced in reality. They check the ways of the innocent and unwary. They bring the individual down to earth and present them with the facts of reality. In their own fashion, the traditions say, pay heed to the teachings of experience or you are a court disaster. I think in a lot of ways, the traditions are a miracle. The fact that this is an organization that's as big as it is and that doesn't have a leader, I think is pretty amazing, and is a democracy. And, you know, when it's used following the traditions,
I agree very much. I mean, it's a bunch of people trying to follow the will of God, you know, with those guidelines. And that's why it works. There's, you know, they're thinking of their role larger than themselves, you know, thinking about service to God and their fellows.
And I do think it's, I like the fact that he says that it's, we learn from the lessons of experience, and I think I like the sentence too. They bring the individual down to earth and present him with the facts of reality.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're going, you know, the steps teach us about ourselves, and the traditions help us with other people in a group situation. And relationships are hard for us.
Yep. It is quite remarkable that it works so well.
And I also see that where you just read, Suzanne, too, they serve as guides for the inexperienced in reality. They check the ways of innocent and unwary. I look at that, too. It really keeps us at a humble state, too. Like the egos, it really brings down everyone's ego if we're practicing the traditions.
Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions. And it's humility.
And I think it's why it's so important that we study the traditions and get to understand them better. But I couldn't do that until I really had an experience with the steps.
Mm.
You know, I tried to do it because, you know, when we're in meetings and there are meetings that, you know, talk about the traditions, but I was really pretty lost on it until I really kind of had better understanding of the step process. And then I was also much more open, and I could really glean a lot from the traditions, although I think you can still glean things from the traditions even if the steps are still, you're still in kind of different places with the steps. But, you know, it's just like, you know, you can glean something listening to the sixth step if you're only on the second step. So...
Mm-hmm.
But once you actually experience it, it's a whole different story. So anything else? Anybody else want to make any comments?
Well, just looking ahead, we got about 3 pages, the next paper, and then 2, the next one. So we'll get through those easily. Would seem they're very good. They're both Grapevine articles, and then there's again back talking to his colleagues at the why psychiatrists fail with alcoholics, and that's 126 minus 21, so that's 5 or 6 pages. So it looks like 2 more sessions probably.
Great. So why don't we close, and Lee, would you like to take us out?
My Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen.
Amen.